You're listening to the Boiler Room Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Classic Album Sundays. I'm Colleen. Welcome to CIS. I see there's a few new faces here. So just kind of to let you know how this is going to work today. We're going to have a presentation from Raj Chowdhury from Boiler Room TV, as well as Living Proof, the hip-hop party. He'll be giving us a whole presentation, the story about J Dilla Donuts, playing some of the samples, just giving a great presentation so you really can learn as much as you can about the album. And now let me put you into the good hands of Raj Chowdhury.
So a quick disclaimer. The way I'm going to sort of structure this talk is kind of bring people up to speed with his back catalogue and then break down the samples of Donuts and some of the, you know, significance of that. And I'm going to do my best not to cry as well. So. The last time I saw J Dilla, it was December 2005. It was a gig at Jazz Cafe, and it was him, Fat Cat, Frank and Dank, and DJ Redmatic. It was a show I tried to put on myself when I'd speaking to the booking agent, but it had various health issues. And at the time, I was working at this record store called Deal Real. We did many in-stores, of which a lot of his associates and people that he worked with, a lot of the DJs, a lot of the MCs, had passed through and done in-stores. And we thought the day after he'd do an in-store at Deal Real. Went to the show, and you know, me being sort of like cheeky kind of young starter in the music industry, I was like, I had a friend at Jazz Cafe, and it was normally quite easy for me to like just go backstage, say hi. I knew a couple of the MCs he was with, but I'd never met J Dilla, who was obviously a hero of mine. I heard he was like in a wheelchair, like in a blanket, so I was like, it's probably best to leave it. And then when he came on stage, he came out in a wheelchair. He started to rap, but he lost his strength to complete a lot of the raps, and all the rappers were finishing the lyrics for him, and they were sort of talking about him, saying stuff like, this guy's a legend, look at all the hits. And they were just doing hit after hit after hit, going, thank you so much, this guy, and he kept thanking the crowd. And then it became really obvious that this was his thing. He was there to say goodbye to the fans. And God, I'm not doing very good, am I?
You're doing great.
His mum was there, his close friends were there, and it was a goodbye. It was a goodbye show. And 2 months later, Donuts dropped. But before we get into Donuts, I kind of want to give the history of sort of where he got to that point in his career. Because for me, Donuts, you can't take away the context of the timing and the placement of his career and his life. It's sort of like, it's just intertwined permanently. So yeah, here are some of the hits that was played. Those tracks you've heard are from Fantastic Volume 1, which is kind of a seminal album, which I guess sort of carved his early sort of sound signature that is kind of known with him, this sort of unquantized loose drum pattern to kind of sub-filtered bass, which at the time you know, it's kind of because it's been mimicked so much, it was very like a unique style at the time. He's a Detroit native. He came from a musical background. His mum was an opera singer. His dad was a jazz bassist. From the age of 18, he was kind of mentored by Amp Fiddler. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with Amp Fiddler, but he was the keys player for Parliament and Funkadelic. He runs a studio where he kind of mentors local Detroit kids. And at the age of 18, Dilla was in that studio regularly, and he got taught the MPC by Amp Fiddler. Funkadelic was on tour with Tribe Called Quest. Amp Fiddler was like to Q-Tip, yo, wait till we get to Detroit, I need to introduce you to this kid called JD. He went through all the different cities, every day going, you need to meet this kid called JD. They met, and Tip was blown away. The beats got circulated to Busta Rhymes and De La Soul and Farside and all these kind of things, and it took him away from Slum Village, and his production got basically pushed out to, you know, some of these people that I'm going to play here.
To my dragon, make me stop whining. I see my influence still shining. Hit you with my ultra violent skin cancer, causing laser beam flow, then cause a riot. Oh shit, I'm gonna give you more and more hot flows. That's gonna help you see who got the real raw. You can watch me rap for the entire 9 seasons. Cold blooded, so they got you motherfuckers freezing. You must find your style. I can defy with your own profile.
You got two of them.
So I guess when people talk about Dilla, this is sort of like the classic era that he's probably best known for, as Questlove call it, the drunk drumming style, the heavy bass, the kind of head nod factor with the kind of like three drumming patterns that became his unique thing. And obviously there was a lot of buzz around this guy. He's like at a young age kind of worked with these quite key artists. I've got a bit of a treat for people, which is via Busta. It was originally a Busta beat, but Biggie jumped on it. Unfortunately never got released, but this is a Biggie and Jay Dilla track that never got released.
Yeah, 96 for my Nostrum Ave niggas, my Fulton Street niggas, my Crawford 96, dangerous baby. MCs.
Check it out.
Diamonds on my neck, chrome drop top, chilling on the scene, smoking pounds of green. Ooh wee, you see the ugliest, money hungriest, Brooklyn Loch Ness, 9mm cock test, one for test, and the winner is not that thinner kid. Bandanas, tattoos, my fists never bruise. Land still cruise. Frank White paid his dues. Ask who's the raw, bet they say Papa Berry. Look forward to me like commissary. All of a sudden, now everybody Big Willie done did it. Come with it.
I mean, if you're a hip-hop fan, like Biggie and Dilla together, it's a fucking big deal. Like, but unfortunately, that never got released. As much as Dilla is revered, there's a lot of kind of, you know, what I see is sort of missed opportunities. Like, there's these producers like Pete Rock and Primo and all these greats, and Dilla's mentioned in those names, but he unfortunately never worked with the Nas's and the Biggies and all these kind of legendary MCs. Not saying that, you know, Dilla didn't work with great MCs, Busta and Common and stuff, but I feel like there could have been more. That's all I'm saying. But he was making waves. Q-Tip was so impressed, he sort of incorporated him into Tribe Called Quest. He essentially became a third producer alongside Q-Tip and Ali Sheed Muhammad, and they formed this group called The Uma. Yes, I'm going to play some of The Uma stuff.
Talking about a revolution, or maybe just a change of mind. Working on my constitution, I began to realize I've been doing wrong forever. Trouble was my favorite game.
What's the next song?
The one about me.
Oh, yeah. I like this one.
What?
You're on point five. Once again, Tip. You're on point five. Once again, Tip. You're on point five. Once again, Tip. Watch me bust they shit.
Okay.
I'm sure you guys are familiar with a lot of that stuff. People look back on the career with like rose-tinted windows. What a lot of people failed to mention, because everyone wears their J Dilla Changed My Life t-shirts and all these kind of stuff, is that at the time, a lot of people blamed J Dilla for Tribe going bad. I mean, they made two classic hip-hop albums with Low End Theory and Midnight Marauders, and the reality of it is actually towards the last two albums, there was internal friction with Q-Tip and Fife Dawg, and J Dilla was this X factor of like, oh, these beats don't sound like how I know him to sound like. That's a whole other thing. People still liked his production, and I guess from the ashes of the Uma grew another even bigger supergroup, which was called Soulquarians, which was sort of led up by Questlove, who you probably all know, like the drummer from The Roots. And there's a progression of sound, because it's no longer just MPC, and it's very much like a collaboration between these keys players and these kind of musicians and these singers. And the Soulquarians kind of led into a new era of his production. So this is the intro to the Common album, which is, it's about as Soulquarians as it gets. It's got like Questlove, James Poyser, Femi Kuti, Fela Kuti's son on sax, Roy Hargrave on trumpet.
Check it out.
Tell me if you want something you can just come on, baby. Tell me if you want something you can just come on. Tell me if you want something you can just.
This is obviously from Volume 2, previous one from Common. That last one was Slum and D'Angelo. And for me, probably the ultimate album that came out of the Soulquarians era was D'Angelo Voodoo, which Questlove tried to teach himself to drum offbeat to be more like Dilla's production value. So like the kind of the creative force was often cited as Dilla alongside Questlove in Soulquarians. But here I'm going to play two Blue Note covers, actually. One from the Welcome to Detroit album, which you played earlier, which is Think Twice, it's a Donald Byrd cover. And another one was a natural official remix for Blue Note, which is Brother Jack McDuff, Obligato.
Yeah, yeah.
The guy had like a range which was like developing over time, and I guess it's probably not talked about because his underground stuff is recognized so much, but this was a guy who was working with Busta Rhymes and Erykah and like big names, so the world could have been his oyster, but it probably didn't pan out as maybe he wanted it to. He saw a lot of the groups that he was with sort of disband. A Tribe Called Quest, like I say, it's quite well documented, had internal conflict, Slum Village similar, and he eventually left those because he didn't want to see a similar thing happen. Far Side, he retells stories of like being on tour and seeing fist fights happen. So a lot of these kind of groups he was associated with, yeah, kind of disbanded. He left Slum Village to focus on what he thought was going to be a breakthrough solo album on MCA, which is a major label. And when MCA got swallowed up or merged with, I can't remember whatever one of the major label mergers, I can't remember what it was, but he had this album just collecting dust, and it was actually him rapping over other people's production, and it had Madlib, it had Pete Rock, it had Kanye West, it had Not, had a bunch of people. I've got another treat, I've got the Kanye and J Dilla track for you.
Kanye West, hot shit. Yeah, what? Frank and Dank in here. Dilla Dog in here. Got McNabb's in here. Set it off in here. Show you how we put it down dirty. Who is it? McNasty and niggas from the block to the bar for the Remy and Rocks. D.I.B. VIP straight to the back.
I mean, if you think about the tracks I played you that didn't make it out, it's J Dilla and Biggie and J Dilla and Kanye. Like, in terms of like iconic rap artists, probably for the golden era of the 90s and contemporary, I don't think you're gonna get two bigger missed opportunities than Biggie and Kanye. It led to a lot of frustration from his end, and what I see, honestly, as like a sort of turning point in his career, which is this, which is a Rough Draft EP, which he self-released on his own label called Mummy. It's moving away from the clean production that maybe he'd been associated with, and he just moved on sonically, even if just for one EP, but it definitely showed quite an interesting change in direction for him.
Before we get this started, let me explain. It's the Rough Draft EP for my real niggas only. DJs that play that real live shit. You wanna bounce in your whip with that real live shit. Sound like it's straight from the motherfucking cassette. Rough Draft, let's do it.
Yeah. What's the deal? Y'all know what this is. It's McNabb. Get ready for my nigga Dilla. Holla.
I had a dream about my man last night. His name is Frank and Dank, that's what's up. The Roots Crew, that's what's up. Bus a Bus, that's what's up. Pete CL, that's what's up. Dead Sure, that's what's up. My niggas keep it ghetto with your plastic cups. It's the
Yo.
If I need the money,
Nasty presents.
For awesome amounts of
dough.
If I need the money,
let's
reach the gate. Awesome amounts of dough. If I need the money,
turn it up.
If I need the money,
yeah.
Well,
money do too. Where you at?
Money.
Rough Draft, motherfucker.
That's meant to sound muddy, kind of mix. He used the same engineer actually that he used for Donuts, and it was sort of a move away from the kind of highly polished stuff like the Uma remixes for Janet Jackson. It definitely felt like quite an intentional, creative sort of new direction for him.
It's in terms of like where he was going with it, a big standing kind of impact that he's had on contemporary music, not just hip hop but beyond, is kind of what he did next. At this point, he was underground and there was no doubting that, but he was very much revered, certainly in the circle I was in, and he was releasing beat tapes that were like, just like, you would do anything to get your hand on a J Dilla beat tape.
Like, you would be like, I used to work in this record, so put it like this, and it was like, who the fuck's got the new expectation? He's got the Dilla beat CD, da, da, da. And be like, oh, can you work Sunday? I'm not working Sunday, fuck off, man. It's like, I got the new beat CD. I'm like, okay, I'll work Sunday. Like, it was like, you crave that, whether it was Soul Seek or like swapping.
Fat Cat came in for an install and he played us these beat CDs, and we were like, fuck, we need to rip these. But he wasn't going to give it to us. We're like, hey, are you hungry? Let's take you out for Nando's. We took him around the corner, just in Carnaby Street, Nando's, ripped all those CDs. Da, 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 da. Like, we would do anything to get hold of the J Dilla beat tapes. Some of this is taken from that Nando's jacking. I mean, for me, like, that the relevancy of these beats is still felt today with the beat scene, Flying Lotus, all these kind of people. Like, I think a lot of them would cite Dilla as an influence. So by this point, it was like, to the people who knew, he was a genius. So genius is a strong word, and I realise, you know, people who maybe aren't in this kind of hip-hop bubble that maybe I am in are like, Miles Davis was a genius. Jimi Hendrix was a genius. What makes this kid with a, not a kid anymore, but what makes this guy with an NPC a genius? Now, if you're talking individually about the craft, there was stuff he did which was like truly remarkable. He did his Gladwellian 10,000 hours. He reached this level of technicality which was unfathomable to his peers. A lot of those tracks he made for Tribe, for Far Side, for the classic hit, he made within 10 to 15 minutes. Now, to put that in perspective, an average hip-hop producer in 10 to 15 minutes may have found a sample and maybe at best being like, I'm going to use that sample. 10 to 15 minutes is a remarkable short time. He had this catalogue of a wall of vinyl where he would go along and he would, in his head, before he even switched on his MPC, know which samples he was going to use, know which bass drum, which, like, all of it planned out and mapped. So that when he switches MPC and bang, 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 it would be finished, all sequenced and programmed within 10 to 15 minutes. That is something which, I don't know, it's like, he's basically like the Rain Man of hip hop production. It really is unfathomable. One of his biggest ambassadors of talking about his technicality is Questlove. And there's a well-known anecdote that Questlove tells, which is, pick me a sample, I'll make it for you in 10, 15 minutes. And Questlove was like, I'm going to do a really obvious tune that's going to be really hard for you to make something unique out of. You had to flip it and you need to make it unrecognizable from the original. So he picked Rick James' Give It To Me Baby. everyone knows it, right? When you got home last night. So within 10 minutes, he made a track and it got used on the like Water for Chocolate Common album.
Keep on. Keep on. Keep on. Keep on.
So it's essentially micro-chopping one bass note and creating a whole new sound out of that. Another good example is, if you guys are familiar with D'Angelo. But just literally that first couple notes. Right here.
You look at step, I see you took.
I mean, he was even basically sampling his peers and making it unrecognizable. And just the way the guy thought. So, Living Proof's the party I run. One of the guys I run it with was a guy called Snips. He produced a track with Guilty Simpson. And obviously, it was like, oh, what's Dilla like in the studio? He wanted to create a snare drum that was unique or just like a bit different. So, he took a bike chain, smashed it against a concrete floor to create a snare drum.
Guilty Simpson. My nigga.
Now, it's not like totally unheard of. I think Squarepusher did it on Feed Me Weird Things, one of his early Reflex albums, where he took the sound of an ant or something crawling on sand and amplified it to try and make a drum rhythm out of it. But in the hip-hop world, it's definitely thinking outside of the box. So why have I spent so much time and not actually mentioned Donuts? Is because how did I feel when Donuts came out? I was very disappointed. I was like, this guy's on top of the game right now in terms of technicality. And here he is doing like 10cc and Diana Ross and Dionne Warwick and the Jacksons and stuff. And taking bait samples, using stuff like obvious drum breaks. And not only is he using this stuff, but he's taking huge chunks of them. It's just like a weird soul mixtape. This isn't the guy on top of his game. And then he died 3 days later. And it changed everything. It changed hip hop, but it changed how that album is viewed. He created essentially a message in the most insane circumstances. He suffered from a rare blood disease called TTP and lupus. For certain, he finished, like it's documented as 29 out of 31 of the tracks from a hospital bed in Los Angeles. He had essentially a portable turntable, an SP-303 sampler, and just a laptop for sequencing. You know, his mum would be like massaging his fingers so he could continue to make beats right up until his death. He was on dialysis. The Stone Throw guys like Wolf and Madlib and J-Rock were bringing in 45s and records to like kind of chop up his stuff. It's a very weird environment to make an album with, I think everyone can agree. With his own personal, and this is the only quote J Dilla has of Donuts, it says, "It's just a compilation of the stuff I thought was a little too much for the MCs. That's basically what it is, you know. Me flipping records that people really don't want to rap on, but they kind of want to rap on." I don't think that's true. I think that's bullshit. I think he's downplayed a lot. He was a very, when he was rapping, he was quite braggadocious. He was quite swagger. But in all interviews, he's very humble. He's very modest. I think this is Dilla understating what he actually did this album. But considering that's the only quote we have of him directly referring to Donuts, essentially everything I'm about to tell you is just my interpretation or some guy's interpretation or House Shoes or J-Rock or blah, blah, blah's interpretation. It's a really interesting dynamic because hip hop essentially is so direct in terms of meaning. The producer creates the groove or the beat or the rhythm and the rapper just literally gives you the meaning. So if NWA is saying Straight Outta Compton, crazy motherfucker called Ice Cube, it's probably about a crazy motherfucker called Ice Cube who's Straight Outta Compton,
Or if they're saying fuck the police, it probably means they don't like the police.
With this, it's one of the few instances in hip-hop where the interpretation really needs to come from yourself rather than directly from lyrics. Not many, although beat tapes were circulated on the internet, not many beat tapes had been released in this sort of format. The only thing I can really reference, which I don't directly consider a hip-hop record, is maybe DJ Shadow's Introducing, in terms of like a seminal album that's based on samples and whatnot. Jeff Jank, who was one of the cornerstones of Stones for a Record, and he designed the record sleeve, he said, Donuts has proven itself a great work of art because it's open to theories. Dilla went from being his own person with a lot of privacy to being the public's person. The public discussion about the work has become a part of what the album is now. And that's it. Like, now it's just like trying to work out what Donuts means to us as a listener. Maybe what he intended. We'll never know, but this guy was dying and he knew that. And yeah, let's talk about Donuts. So it's 31 songs, clocks in at 44 minutes. With the exception of one track, every song is less than 2 minutes long. The opening track is called Donuts Outro. It's a 30-second skit that loops a Shuggy Otis guitar note to create a kind of surreal introduction with the open phrase J Dilla repeated like a mantra. I don't care. It's fucking weird. Like, I don't think anyone can listen to Donuts and not say it's a weird album. The first thing you'll probably notice is that the intro is called Outro and the last track is called Donuts Intro. The last track actually ends with the same 13 seconds that the album starts with. So in a way, it loops. It's a circle, or you could say a donut. It's not a perfect loop. The album is filled with a lot of mistakes. He looked for samples where the drums were slightly off or a bass note was slightly out, and he sort of thrived on that. And I guess even his classic sound, which we think is polished, is actually fundamentally based on unquantized, slightly loose drums. There's tracks being, like a record, being lifted up and played again or rewound. I mean, it's pretty sloppy, right? So intro, outro, I mean, throughout the album, there's themes in the titles of symmetry or collation of ideas or sequences. Track 28 is called High. The following track is called Bye. One track's called Dilla Says Go. Another track is called Stop. Tracks called Waves, Light My Fire and Thunder, which maybe it's reading too much into it, but it seems to reference the four elements, which I guess in Western cultures is seen as sort of like the key, you know, to life as we know, I guess. Track 12 is called Airworks. The following track is called Lightworks. One track is called 111. The following track is called Two Can Win. I guess if you have no rappers, there is the fundamental question of how do you convey messaging? And I'm sure a person dying who is spending his last moments creating music, even to the point where 2 months before he died, he was on tour around Europe in a wheelchair. And according to Questlove, he created his last beat literally hours before he passed away. So how do you create a message with no rappers? And all we can do is take a guess at the way he used the samples, because there's definitely phrasing, there's definitely the way he chopped up words, there's definitely the way he chopped up samples and what he tried to do with it, which, I don't know, I guess it means something. So beyond that weird 13-second skit is these guys, 10cc, a British rock band, not traditionally in the world of Dilla, but he sampled from lots of kind of weird stuff, lots of like prog rock bands like Gentle Giant and Yes and Steve Howe and stuff like that. But there's a quite tongue-in-cheek song called The Worst Band in the World. He retook snippets from it, and it's quite a tongue-in-cheek intro to an album, because he literally phrases out play me, buy me, working on it, which if you're an artist, you kind of want your customer or listener to play you, buy you, blah, blah, blah. And then it ends it with the slightly more somber fade me, and the way he kind of filters the sample, it says save me.
Play me, buy me, working on it, working on it.
So the following track is also by 10cc. It's a track called Johnny Don't Do It. And in the track, it's about basically a reckless guy who steals a motorbike from a garage, and the motorbike didn't have brakes. And there's sort of this kind of quite eerie breakdown in the middle, sort of this choral thing where the band say, Johnny, don't do it, and it's sort of overlaid with a news report of this guy dying.
The truck pulled out, he tried to step on the brake.
So you'd think you'd make the obvious connection because it's a song about death with the fact that he's dying, but he doesn't. He takes out the word don't to create, again, another strange loop. It basically says, Johnny, do it.
Let's go!
What's he talking about? He's talking about his younger brother, John Yancey, who sort of launched his music career almost, you know, straight after J Dilla passed away, rapped under the name Illa J, rapped on J Dilla beats. And yeah, there's a lot of messaging, very personal messaging. Directly after the Waves track is a 30-second snippet that is Light My Fire, which is obviously sort of like the passing on of the legacy of the Yancey family. It came from the music family, passed on to the brother. And there's a James Brown vocal snippet which says, what up and rap it, which is kind of echoed in this song. There's quite a few, going back to sequencing, there's quite a few examples where the song directly after conveyed a full stop to the sentence previous. So on the track Don't Cry, which I'm gonna go to in depth later on, is a track called Anti-American Graffiti. Obviously Don't Cry is to his mum and brother saying, literally, don't cry. And the immediate sentence after in American Graffiti is, my family tree is my history. He's taking the lyrics of the source material and he's making his own sort of sentences or his own sort of message with it. Couple tracks down the line, there's a track called Stop, like one of my favorite tracks to be honest, and it takes a vocal snippet from this Jadakiss track, which I'm gonna play quickly.
Is that real? Yo, why is Jada Kiss as hard as it gets? Why is the industry designed to keep the artists in debt?
So just on a very simple level, it's just a sort of rapper outburst which says, it's that real. What he does is chop off the T and sort of stutter the sample, overlays it over the Dionne Warwick sample and creates a phrase that says, is death real? So the one thing I like to say is it's not all just an album about really somber or depressing like stuff. It is a hip-hop album. There's a lot of bangers on it that are quite raw drums, and a lot of the hidden messages aren't all about death. There's a track on the album called Lightworks, which is again sampled from a guy called Raymond Scott. Raymond Scott is this American-based electronic composer. He kind of created weird instruments and synths and modulators. He founded the Manhattan Research Project. The easiest way to relate to it, it's like the American equivalent of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. So they just sat there with their weird machines and made kind of like compositions. BBC Radio Phonic Workshop made theme tunes and did stuff like the Doctor Who theme tune. In a similar way to Warner Brothers purchased a lot of the catalogue of Raymond Scott and actually turned it into like Looney Tunes cartoons like Bugs Bunny stuff and even Ren and Stimpy. But this particular track, Lightworks, was a 1960s jingle for Lightworks Cosmetics. So it's actually, weirdly enough, it's about eye makeup and lipstick. So that's why the lyrics are about sparkling eyes and teasing lips.
What is the magic that makes one's eyes sparkle and gleam, light up the skies? The name of the game is Lightworks. Sparkle and gleam, light up the skies. The name of the game is Lightworks. How do you show those teasing lips so they dazzle and shine? His heart does flips. The name of the game is Lightworks.
So obviously Dilla hip-hops it up a bit.
This is Bendix, the Tomorrow People.
What is the magic that makes one's eyes sparkle and gleam, light up the skies? The name of the game is Lightworks.
Now, it sounds like just a basic re-edit, which on much closer inspection, it's not. There's underlying elements within the track which aren't loops, and he's brought in different things. And the sort of the best example I've seen of actually displaying that is J-Rock, who, the lucky bastard, has got the hard drive with a lot of the stems to these productions, and he often sort of plays the underlying beat and chops before he kind of brings in the drums. But the obvious one, my favourite chop, is sort of at the end of the track, which again sort of plays with the vocal stuff that he did with the Jadakiss sample with It's Death Real. Did anyone spot it? Light up the spliffs. I promise you, there's nowhere in a 1960s cosmetic advert that says spliffs. He took the word lips and microchopped this S and created his own word. Like he just and like no one really is going to notice. It's just like for fun. But it's, you know, on first inspection or first listen, you listen to Donuts and it's not that same level of immediate, like, oh, he really fucked up that D'Angelo sample. He really, you know, must have that Rick James thing. It's not as immediate, but there's intricacies within the production that you really need to kind of inspect. Like, there's loads of examples of where he's taken a sample which is just, you know, one tempo, one sort of rhythm, and he slows it down and speeds it up almost seamlessly. If you kind of know a production, especially with the equipment he was using before kind of like time stretching in kind of Ableton and stuff like that, slowing down and speeding samples without affecting the pitch of the drum beats and the sample itself is very, very difficult. And he does it time and time again within the album. A really good example, because obviously the name titling of it is Time, Don't of the Heart, which I'm going to get to later about how people deal with death, but it's sort of like a slowing down of time, which directly references the title as well. Another good example is Don't Cry, which I'm going to go to in a bit more depth. But this is the original sample. It's a track called The Escorts. I Can't Stand to See You Cry.
Don't cry. Don't cry.
And this is what Dilla did with it. It goes up, down, multiple times.
Don't cry.
I'll show you how my voice has made an unbelievable thing good.
Oh, okay, Joy.
With this track, I'm gonna get a bit geeky here, but I found this even more geeky guy on the internet
who tried to recreate the chops. There's a guy called Darius Kazemi, and he took 6.5 hours to create 2.6 seconds of the track. So these are the chops, which are.
So if you think a traditional hip-hop producers just take a sequence of a four-bar loop and they loop it, when you're dealing with some of these chops, if you imagine it's a three-minute track and they take a chop at 30 seconds and then 45 and then 61 seconds and blah, 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 and then they sequence it and it actually musically still, you know, has that pitch that works, it's not an easy thing. That's 2.6 seconds, so...
I don't know what to say.
I mean, his ear was incredible when it comes to chopping and sampling. And obviously, this isn't your traditional very smooth, you know, like some of the records I pulled out here. This is very much, I guess, sort of like a music concrete approach to sampling. And I think the original Stone's Throw press release said something along the lines of, it's like flicking through a radio in a new city where you're just like switching from like, you know, like, and that's very much the approach he was going for. And it's not an accident because you don't do stuff like that by accident. It's just far too complex. So one thing I would recommend if you guys want to kind of look more into perhaps this book, it's part of 33 and a third range of books, which sort of like takes one album and dissects it. It's by Jordan Ferguson, and a very interesting, I guess, theory or medical academia, if that's the right phrase. But in the 60s, a Swiss psychiatrist called Elizabeth Kubler-Ross published her book on death and dying. And in this book, her and her students essentially interviewed a bunch of terminally ill people to recognise the different stages that people go through. And the medical profession see this as like five quite recognised reactions to when you know you're dying or grief, and it's not necessarily linear, it can happen at any point and it can skip between the different five stages. The book references some songs which they believe is attributed to each one of these five stages. So the first stage, which for me seems obvious, if someone told me I was going to die, is denial. In the track, Dilla says go. The lyrics used, it's all right, I'll get over it, baby.
Yeah.
The second stage is anger. There's a few tracks on this album which are quite jarring, and it's maybe one of the reasons I didn't actually like it when I first, because they get in your face, and probably no more than this track, Glazed, which, considering this guy was a pretty proficient producer in chopping and creating lovely smooth sounds for Erykah Badu to sing on, you know, these are quite harsh and abrupt chops with the mix as well, like the drums are in your face, the sample is quite a lot of high end. This is a track called Glazed, which the book attributes to anger. The third stage is bargaining, which is whether it's a spiritual bargaining or, you know, medical bargaining. In the track Stop, which lifts from this Dionne Warwick sample, very beautiful vocals, it is one of my favourite tracks. The lyrics go, you're going to want me back in my arms, you're going to need me one day, you better stop and think about what you're doing, give a little back my way. Might be reading too much into it, but the whole 44 minutes of this album, it's done like a mixtape. There are no pauses for silence, there's no like fade down and fade in, everything just goes one into the other like a mixtape, one continuous mix. The only individual bar of silence comes in this track Stop, after the last stop of that chorus I just played, and I guess one could argue that it's Dilla saying, if I die, the music's gonna stop. Only lasts a second, might be reading too much into it, but the thing is, no one knows. The fourth stage is depression. There's a track called Walking On It. It's Walk On By, which I'm sure you guys are all familiar with. It's a Burt Bacharach song, first recorded by Dionne Warwick, and it's been like covered a million times, and the bits that everyone know is walk on by, the lovely bit, but this very clearly focuses on the loop of Broken and Blue, and it's probably the most unsubtle messaging. The final and fifth stage is acceptance, which Dylan knew he was going to die. He didn't really tell many people, but him, you know, and his mother definitely knew. Kubler-Ross, the woman who wrote this book, said, if the patient has had enough time to process this situation, he will have mourned the loss of so many meaningful people and places. They will contemplate its coming end with a certain degree of quiet expectation. Now, probably the stage which is most prevalent within the album is acceptance. There's obviously the messaging to his little brother. There's the don't cry. In the track People, the lyrics simply are, people, people, the time has come, my people, hold on.
People! People, the time has come. Say it, say it, say it.
My people.
My people.
The the typical hip-hop loops. He's literally taking phrases from different parts of the song and placing them to create phrases. So it's not by accident that these things are being said. And, you know, as well as acceptance, there are songs which are just plainly about love. So that song's about love.
It's called You Love.
And ultimately, that's what I guess what this album is. It's so hard for me as a listener to separate the fact that this is a document of a dying man. A lot of albums have been released since. Kareem Riggins finished off The Shining, and his mum and the J Dilla estate have released lots of posthumous albums, and Delicious Vinyl have released Illa J. But this was Dilla, and this is his last ever document to the world. You know, and he dedicated his life to this. For me, and this is like totally unfounded by any sort of science or facts. And I tried to Google it and I couldn't find it. But I think someone told me, and I'm going to pretend it's someone medical, but from 1999 to 2000, a lot of old people died January 1st, January 2nd, January 3rd. And it was the willing of kind of like persistence that they wanted to see a new millennium. For me, I don't see it as a coincidence that he lived to see the album that came out on his birthday and died 3 days later. And a similar thing happened, you know, with David Bowie. I don't know, it's just too weird for me to accept that that's a coincidence. The last track on the album, gonna play on vinyl. Not yet. This is the only track which is called Donuts Intro, which I'm going to play the J Dilla version first. With everything I've played, it's him taking source material, rewording it or rephrasing it or kind of reframing the meaning behind it. With this, it's almost the other way around, where the sample doesn't give too much away. But he's not stupid, like people like myself who rigorously corrected beat tapes and searched for samples. He knows that people are going to do some digging. The track that he plays, Donuts Intro, obviously ends with that 13-second sample, but essentially just says, be the kind of man that you thought I could be.
Welcome to Wayne Scrobney Talks with a Superstar. Tonight, Wayne's guest, the incredible. So
the original track is actually by a Canadian pop band
who are literally a one-hit wonder. And this is the album. It was released in 1969 and they disbanded in 1970. And that one-hit wonder is a track called When I Die, which is the source material for the final track on the album, or the beginning if you take this loop thing seriously. The lyrics say, when I die, I hope to be a better man than you thought I'd be. It's been hard to make you see what kind of man I'm trying to be. All I ask for you to try to understand what it means to be me.
When I die, I hope to be a better man than you thought I'd be. It's been hard to make you see what kind of man I'm trying to be. All I ask for you to try to understand what it means to me.
Thank you.